two or three years ago, I was challenged to write a book that would reflect the events of the early years of the Holden development. And during, and I got started on that, and I've written about 100 pages or so. But there was illness in my family, and a death of one of my family members, my wife. And so I had to put away my writing for quite some time. I wasn't in the mood to write for a long time, nor did I have the time to do it. And it has also been my ambition to write my life story. You know, I feel that I have lived a very interesting life. I've been involved in a great many things that are worth remembering and worth writing about. And my family has been on me for a long time that I must write my life story. I have two children, a boy, a son and a daughter. And their families have produced 8 great-grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. And they're all on my neck to get this thing done before I do anything else. But I feel very much obligated to do this Holden thing too. And so I have an outline that I have made some time ago, mostly in my mind, about how I would organize that book. And I would like to have you help me tonight. You're going to ask some questions. Now, many of you have been in some of the sessions before, and you know what I covered. But this is the outline that I have in mind for the Holden story. Chapter 1, to cover the discovery of copper and gold bearing ore in beautiful Copper Mountain, and the efforts of pioneer prospectors to make their golden dreams come true. Chapter 1. Chapter 2, to cover the years when the House on Mining Company developed a successful mining operation and the building of beautiful Holden Village. Number 3, to reflect on the founding years when Holden Village came into Lutheran focus. And under that heading, I have some sub-chapters. The light is not very good here, or something. But the appraisal process was number 1. Number 2, creating a new a corporate entity. Number 3, the renovation of the ghost town, or the ministry of sweat and dirty hands. Number 4, the reflections related to achieving Holden Village goals. Those roughly make up an outline of what I have in mind to write. And I think now, as I think of it, that I probably will be obligated to finish this sometime next year. And I'm going to try to take enough time off from my business and other activities. I'm going to try to put them out of my mind. I'll go someplace where I can get away from the telephone and all the other involvements and spend some time writing it out. I'm not a writer, but I'm going to make a stab at it, and I've got 100 pages already written. And I'm hoping that I can make it just not a lot of facts put together. Others can do that, and some have. But I want to bring some human interest into it. And that's what I've tried to weave into this Holden story. And this was what I hope that I can continue to do. Now with that outline, I'm going to ask you, what phase of this thing do you want to hear about tonight in the few minutes that we have? Do you have any specific questions that would lead to something different from what I have already and declare it during this week.
I wonder what your thoughts and dreams are for the future holding.
About the future?
Yeah.
Well, I rather think that other people should be involved in that. Don't you?
Well, of course, you are going to...
I have some ideas on that.
Yeah.
But maybe I can touch on it after I've touched on some of the other things.
Okay. You might end up kind of with just a little statement or something on that, what your hopes are.
Yes. You see, I've been out of action here for quite a number of years. I was here for 4 years, 1960, 61, 62, and 63. And I have been back to the village every year, except the last two when I wasn't able to come. So I've been out of touch with the village pretty much and haven't known exactly what's going on all the time. But there's always the question or what comes up to mind about whether what the future will be. I'm very much interested. And I'm just wondering if it's all that we hoped it would be in the beginning. And much of it, I think, has been.
By the way, I was wondering, your chapters in the resume of what is happening and so on, you haven't mentioned about what Creve or his letters and that. Those items, would that kind of fit in there in too?
Yes, I think that would come into chapter one. Of course, the thing started with his letters.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think I mentioned that, was it yesterday or day before? But I'll mention it again for those of you that are new. West Creve, you know, after the mining company shut down, they advertised this village for sale. That was 1957 that they closed down. And it attracted an awful lot of attention because the media took a hold of it, made a ghost town of this. And they wrote some very wonderful articles about what Holden had been and what it could be. I read those, just as Wes Preet did. But he beat everybody to the punch and wrote a letter to the House on Money Company and asked about the availability and the price of the village. Well, he got some answers that the village was available and that the price had been reduced to $100,000, which was way below what it was worth. But you know, this is a one-deal operation and it's not something that's easy to sell. You don't appraise these properties on the terms of what it's worth in terms of dollars, but what it's worth to some other corporation that can operate it as we're doing. There were quite a number of people that were interested in this place, but none of them qualified with the Forest Service.
I was wondering if you might mention about West Creek, to those that don't know. He was in Alaska at the time, missionary to the Indians. He is now running the bull hog down here. So.
Yes. Wes is in the village, and if you haven't met him, you should go down to the pool hall and meet him. He's quite a character. And he's the one that triggered this whole thing. I had lunch with him today for the specific purpose of asking him some questions about something that had bothered me over the years. Some people have said that he asked for this gift, but he never did. He just asked about the availability. And when that telephone call came to him, he was just as surprised as the rest of us. He hadn't asked for a gift. But the time came when the House on Sound Company gave up the idea of trying to sell it, that they'd have to give it and take a tax credit. And that's what they did. And because Wes had written to them, they knew about LBI. And so they called him and told him that this thing was available as a gift. Does that answer your question?
No, absolutely.
But you should meet Wes. He's quite a fellow. And he's been back here almost every year since that time and has contributed a great deal in his way. So, have you any other questions that we could discuss here for the few minutes that we have? Okay. Speak a little bit loudly if you can.
I think it was quite interesting. We hiked up to Honeymoon Heights and the things that you told me earlier in the day about that, how that was formerly going to be the village.
Okay.
I also wondered, did they live up there and how did they manage that hike every day if they were working?
You know, well, I'll tell you about it.
Good.
At the time we came up here to appraise this property, we accidentally, more or less, when we were walking between the mine level and the second level up there, I saw a sign lying in the ditch there, and I was curious, and I went over and turned that around, and on there it said Honeymoon Heights. And we saw some evidence that there had been a path up the side of the Copper Mountain. And I knew at that time we didn't have time to go up there, but it intrigued us very much. And later on we found out that that's where the miners' village was started. The miners that came up here were forced to build their own homes, and that was the place that was designated to be their place to build a home. And that's what they did. But they soon learned that that was a dangerous place to be. And you can just imagine why. It was on the side hill there and subject to being swept away by the avalanches. And it was therefore determined that they had to build their homes down here on the flat. And so the honeymoon days were over quickly, and they built then 60 homes down on the flat. Some people have said there was 100 there, but I think they must have counted by two, because I never could get more than 60 out of it. And I think I'm more correct than some of those that said there was 100. So that was quite a deal up there, and there's some evidence up there. If you go up there, you'll see some foundations and all. And very interesting. And I imagine there were some honeymooners up here that needed a house, and they called it the Honeymoon Heights.
I thought of the long trek had they lived up there of getting down to the mine.
Well, it isn't that far. Well, it's further from the miners' village. If you haven't been there, you should go down there too now. The houses are all gone. That was burned in 1962. And now it's a drain field for the sewer system. It's considerable change taking place in that area.
Were those homes burned accidentally, or were they set afire?
Pardon?
Were the homes burned accidentally, or were they set afire? The 60 homes that were over here.
Were they set on fire? They were set on fire, yes. The House on Mining Company and the Forest Service, too, wanted this corporation to take that over. But when we walked through that village the first time, we found that about half the homes there had caved in. And the mess that was up there was just beyond our belief. And we quickly determined. The first time I was there, I said to myself, this is something we must not touch. You see, those homes were built quite differently than the buildings here in the village. These buildings are designed to shed the snow from the roofs. They're steep, and most of the big buildings are metal roofs, and they will shed the snow. And you know, the snowfall up here is terrific. It'll get up to 10 feet of snow here, and the weight of that snow and ice can build up to tremendous proportions. And there they had built homes for themselves, and they knew they would be present, and that they could shovel the snow off the roofs and thereby protect them. But during the 3 years that there was no one here, there was no one there to shovel those roofs, and they consequently caved in. But that was a beautiful village. When we were there, the rock gardens and the flowers and all were doing real well. And some of those homes were quite good. There was quite an investment. And of course, when the mining company decided to abandon this area, they lost everything. They lost those homes. Some of them offered the homes to us. Well, we'd already been offered them by the Forest Service, but we'd already turned it down. So that was quite a drama up there. And it was just too bad. And I know that a lot of the owners there left the village crying about it. And I heard from a number of them during the time we were here, indicating that they hated to lose those homes and that they had a real good life in that area. It's a beautiful place. You know, it's about as beautiful as it can be. So, and they had good jobs here and good pay. So it was a way of life that they didn't want to leave.
Gail, what's interesting is up there in the miners' village, the daffodils and lilacs are still blooming.
That's right. When we came up,
all these years.
When we came up here the first time, it was one of the first days in June, and they were in full bloom at that time. And we were surprised. And they were also in bloom here in the village. That's about the only sign of anything that was nice, was the daffodils were in bloom. And some of them were almost coming up through the snowbanks that were still here on the first days in June that year. Now that daffodil, you know, is a very hardy flower. And you can hardly blot them out. They become a weed after a while. And they keep coming up. You see, that must be about almost 30 years since the original bulbs were planted. And you know, that's the kind of a plant where you need to divide them occasionally, but nature evidently has been there and divided them for them. And that was the only bright thing we found up there that day.
Gil, I was curious to find out, is all this property non-taxable as a non-profit corporation?
Is it non-taxable?
Yes. Is it, you pay taxes here on any part of it?
No.
It's religious.
None that I know of. You see, this is Forest Service ground that we're on now. The buildings here belong to us, but they are all built on Forest Service ground. And the only ground that Holden owns is the mining claims up above here. All that mining area is owned by Holden.
And they don't have to pay taxes on that either.
Elmer, has any taxes been paid on that? None that I know. We didn't pay any when I was here.
We have Dom Lake property, 25, and one piece of that has been put on roll. Otherwise, we pay no property tax.
No.
Do you pay rent to the Forest Service for
this
land?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Holden Village is operated under a permit. And when we came here that first time, the appraisal team, we didn't know all the things about this. We didn't know what the gift was subject to. We didn't know who owned what, and all we knew that we had a telephone call and that the village was available. But we knew nothing about the legal aspects of it. And we had to learn that later on. There was a salvage company active in the mining area at the time we came up. They had wrecked a number of buildings up there, and they were in the process of removing all the best steel from the mining area. And we didn't know exactly how we stood with them either, now that the gift had been made. We later on found out that their contract was going to end that year. And it did end. Their contract called for closing date. And they talked us into letting them continue for another year, and we rented that because there was a lot of things there that we didn't want. And they were fine people, they were cooperative and offered us quite a bit of assistance. We thought too that they might offer us some of the steel that we wanted, and we later on negotiated so we got steel to build the bridge, the new bridge, and we also saved some of the buildings that we needed in that area. So it worked out beautifully like everything else did.
Did you answer the question previously of why they moved out so fast? The people who, you did answer that. It sounded like it was a well-kept secret, and then bang, and one day they all left. The mining company.
I don't know exactly why they made it so fast, but you know, they gave them a termination date, and after that nobody had a job.
Yeah.
And there was nothing else to do. They had no choice. So I think the exodus only took a few days. Many people left things behind that they ordinarily would take with them. The miners' village was full of things up there, even some furniture. And they hadn't. The barber had left the scissors and a number of things in the barber shop. They left in such a hurry. The tables were all set in the hotel. That was one of the big surprises that we ran into on that day of appraisal. We walked into the dining room and the tables were all set. It was hard to understand, but they left in a hurry that day. They wasn't sure there was going to be another meal.
Thank you. I noticed in walking around that the mining claim is posted with a proper document on a post in a number of places showing where the claims are. One thing I was wondering is there an obligation to hold that claim? Do you have to do any mining development to retain the ownership of the claim?
Well, I think it's just normal that you have to do some work on a mining claim every year. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Mr. Witt, you can tell them more about that than I can,
because
I haven't seen those.
We have an agent who stakes those claims, checks them, and does the assessment work that reports to the state for keeping those claims alive. And there is a certain amount of work that we do and other things that have to be done each year to keep those claims current. That's correct.
And it's
the Sunshine Valley Mineral Company does that in our behalf.
And it's your intention to continue to keep those claims in a positive fashion by
that's correct
by taking care of whatever obligations are needed to ensure that the claim is valid
without question.
Because if you wouldn't do that, there'd be a cutoff date, and some other people are going to come in and take those over. So I was wondering what the rules were.
We work on that, and we now have an agreement that we get evidence 1 month in advance of the deadline that all that work has been done and submitted, because we don't even want to go over the deadline. The deadline is August 31st. And
is that each year that there
yes.
must be a...
Right.
I have one more curiosity question about the hotel. All these dishes and everything that was left in there, did they get dropped down here then, so they're being in use now, like the towels, the bedding, the dishes and everything from the hotel? They sure they didn't burn that all up, did they?
No, they left everything. They just walked out leaving everything.
Did you bring it
what
down?
Happened
did
to
you bring
them?
It down here, the dishes?
No, they were left in the hotel.
And just burned?
If you take a walk up to the third level in the hotel, or the fourth level, that's one big room. It's bigger than this room, I think. And that was just loaded with all kinds of dishes. And some of them were not good. But there was a lot of new supplies up there as well. And they were left there. And because it was on that third floor, I think the people that came up here didn't know they were there. So very little was lost as far as the dishes in that storeroom. And the blankets, we found those in dorm 6, or the bottom floor of dorm 6. And they were all in a walk-in
cooler.
And of course the doors were open, but you know that cooler was stacked high with hundreds of blankets and pillows from floor to ceiling. And the sad thing is that when we came back one time later, they were all gone. That happened after we left here in 1960. We had watchmen in here for a month and a half, two different ones. Wes Priebe was one of them and Randy Stein was the other one. And after they left, somebody came in here and with a pack train from the west side, and they lifted all of that wonderful material in that cooler. So that was one of the things we lost. And besides that, we lost a lot of things. We lost some of these chairs. These are valuable chairs. We later on found some down in the resort area along the lake, and I know that people had helped themselves. We also saw sheets and pillows down there with stamped House on Money Company, so we knew where they'd come from. But it's a surprising thing, and this is one of the miracles of this village, that more things weren't taken, because there are people coming in here hunting and fishing, and the resort people down below are bringing people up here almost every day to see the ghost town. It was highly advertised that this place was a ghost town, and it aroused the curiosity of people all over the country. And they came up here, carloads of them, and went through the village, and the resort people didn't care if they lifted something. And when I was here one day, a fellow came up here, and we were in one of the houses up here, and he saw this telephone hanging on the wall. And he asked me, would you look the other way if I took that phone? And I said, no, but gee, I think I'm bigger than you are, and you better not touch him. And he didn't. But you can just imagine that all these people that come here, how tempting it was to take them. And I want to tell you that we found all the keys to the village stacked on a table in the hotel cook's room there. And that really opened my eyes. I thought, my goodness, the Lord surely is watching over this place. There wasn't a door in the village that was unlocked. They stood open, mind you. Some of them were not closed even. And the deer and the rats and everything else had free entry to all these buildings, as well as all the tourists that came up here. So that's one of the miracles. Now we're concerned about fire. And here, during those years, nobody, there was not a fireman, there wasn't any water in the system, no way to fight a fire. And here, the village stood safe all those years, except for the damage that the vandals did, and of course there was some snow damage too. It was quite some experience to walk through this village. We walked through every room in the village, and we determined that this village was a good one. Under all the dust and everything, we saw a lot of good things. And that was one of the factors that made this thing feasible. If it had been an ordinary mining village, we wouldn't have even looked at it. They're mostly shacks, you know. But this was built to last, and you know, these buildings now are 50 years old. And the wood that's in them and the structural quality of this is just as good as the day it was built. But it takes a lot of money and a lot of effort to maintain them. And that's something that the board has to struggle with now.
Gil, I've been very impressed with the
sprinkler systems and the fire system, the fire alarm system you got here. A man now has applied a cost of entry too for the home department buildings camp here.
Well, I'll tell you about the fire system when we arrived here. We had these hose houses that you see in the village, and they had holes and axes and everything required to fight a fire. And they had a triangle in one of them that was something that people could beat if there was a fire, and you could hear it all up and down the valley. And I tested those, that triangle with a beater, and nearly frightened the chipmunks to death when I beat that triangle. And they had a main firehouse over here. It was swept away in an avalanche several years later. And in there was a truck with the holes and the axes and a lot of things that. It was a funny little old thing, but it had a lot of good equipment in it. But that's the only fire department. I really hand it to the people that took over after I left. They put in all this complete system, and you'll notice that there's a sprinkling system in all these buildings. And if they had a fire today, it wouldn't last long. And there's a lot of automatic equipment here that much of it, I don't know exactly what's all here, but I have observed that it's a pretty safe deal now. But it's something that the operators here have to be very careful about. And the Forest Service is constantly after them, I think, to maintain a good, safe village.
Did any other organizations try to acquire this property before LBI got it?
I don't have the names of any organization, but I've heard that there were quite a number of organizations that were interested. Some of them were interested in developing a high-class resort up here. But you know, the Forest Service wouldn't qualify those people. They wanted somebody in here, if they were going to have anyone, they wanted people that they could depend on to take care of it and operate it safely in this environment, which is a very fragile area, really it is. A fire could sweep through this village, you know, and you couldn't begin to stop it. So I think it's just a miracle that we ever got it.
You knew they wouldn't be drinking and wild parties and things like that going on here, like if it was in a resort.
I couldn't quite understand.
They wouldn't be drinking and wild parties and so on, like it would be with a resort. Which, in other words, it'd be better living here, better taken care of. She said there wouldn't be so much drinking or parties if somebody else had it.
Yes, well.
Like a resort, that could be more danger for fire because of that, is what I meant.
During the years of the Hassan operation, they weren't allowed to sell liquor here. People had to get their own liquor and hide it too. There was no public drinking here whatsoever.
Do you ever have avalanches on that big hill right behind here?
Oh yes, there's avalanches, but you see where? Quite well protected here. The closest one was just up the road here, a couple hundred feet, when it swept out one garage and the firehouse. There's all kinds of evidence of avalanches. You go up to the ball field there or the miners' village, you can see any place where there's leaf trees and brush. That's because there's an avalanche been there that has swept the big trees out. One time when I was here, I was the witness of an avalanche off of Buckskin. And you wouldn't believe the noise that caused. That's something that's really dangerous. Big rocks and trees and everything comes down. And of course, this was at a time when there was very little snow up there. But it's the snow that starts sliding. sometimes they'll have a snowfall of a couple of feet, and then they'll have some rain on it, and that will freeze, and then it'll snow on top of it, and when the weight gets heavy enough, it'll just start sliding. And but I think as far as avalanches are concerned, this village is quite safe. We've got a lot of big trees back here, and no areas above there that wouldn't hold the deep snows. It would take quite a super winter of snows, I think. And they've had snows here that have been record snows. So I don't think you have to worry so much about the danger of an avalanche. If you were to ask me what phase of this whole development has impressed me the most, I would have to say that it's the volunteers, the ministry of sweat and dirty hands. How we challenged hundreds and hundreds of people to come up here and renovate this village, I think is one of the miracles of the whole development. And that was in all phases of it, including the appraisal and the development of an entity to operate this place. Everything worked so beautifully. And seemed to be a group of people, men and women, anytime you needed something, they would be here. And you know that most of these volunteers came up here and paid for their board and room to work up here. And of course, our connections with the youth departments of the Lutheran Church, that too proved to be a very wonderful process.
Did all the different synods of the Lutheran Church chip in on that and work with it, or was there just certain groups of the Lutheran?
Well, there were people from many synods, but there was none of them that paid anything except ELC and LFC and Augustana. And of course, these synods at that time were in the process of union. And this was before the union took place. I was on that union committee as a member of the LFC, and I knew all about it. And that was one way I got acquainted with so many of these youth people. And I knew that it would be very difficult to approach the big wheels in the big synods, but we'd have to reach them through the youth departments. And that's how the youth departments had such a prominent role in the early days. And of course, they suggested that the program here be designed to meet the needs mostly of young adults. And although many of us thought that this was a village that should be for all ages, and that's what it's proved to be in the long run. But it had to have that emphasis in order to get these people involved. And that's the only way we could get this thing on a national basis. Isn't that right, Elmer?
That's right. Later on, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod put about $5,000 a year in here, I think, for about 5 years. But that was later. That was 65 to 70, something like that.
The
ALC, after the merger, had by far the most money
right
put in.
It wasn't their financial contribution as much as the support we got otherwise.
Yes.
We got a lot of program help and the recruitment help from these youth departments.
Right.
Augustana was very prominent in this, and
they
don't exist anymore.
Right.
Dr. Bergstrand was the head of it, and I knew him. And we got him involved, and he was a firecracker. Really a wonderful help to this whole adventure.
Gil, I think it'd be interesting to all of us if we knew what kind of budget they're operating on. If there's any indebtedness on Long Jones here, maybe you could fill us in on that.
We didn't worry too much about the budget in the beginning. We needed help. We needed people with strong hands and a willingness to work. And we raised the money that we needed to buy the materials. But you'd be surprised how many of the materials too were contributed, as well as the many hours that many people provided. There were experts in every field available at the time we needed them. It was just a miracle that you just had to go down there and tell somebody that you knew that we needed help, and they'd come up here and provide it, and they'd pay their board and room and not give you a bill for it. For instance, all the roofs in the building in the village were painted by a friend who was a painting contractor. Came up here with his crew and spraying machine, power equipment, and he painted the whole thing in a week. And we never got a bill for that. And I can name you a lot of things that contribute. The hydro plant, I've told you, most of you, this before, and many other things. The chime, the organ, and just a long list of things that were contributed. But the valuable thing was the willingness on the part of people to contribute. It was no job whatsoever to get people up here. And many of them became long-term friends of the village.
Do I understand correctly, if someone volunteers now for 3 weeks or more, you get your free room and board?
I don't think I understood your question.
If someone volunteers now to come for 3 weeks or more during the summer, you get free room and board, right? It includes your board and room.
That's right.
That's right. I don't know everything about the operation today. You'll have to ask Elmer those questions.
Well, Megan, would you want to fill us in a little bit on some of those things up to date now?
Sure. He asked about the budget today.
Yeah, what
about $600,000 for operations.
1 year.
Right. That's, that's meaning that all the labor is donated. If you want to get a realistic budget, you have to probably double or maybe even triple that. But the great needs now, we'll probably be operating in the black this year in operations. But the great needs are these things that are coming due, like the sewer, that ate up all of the money that we had set aside. So both for capital as well as for our operation, we're trying to get enough money set aside so that if something unpredictable goes wrong, we're able to handle it. You don't, in an isolated place like this, you can never predict what's going to go wrong. So just having hand-to-mouth or ending up the year with $30,000 or $40,000 is not a very reliable way of operating. So we're trying to build up some operating base. And then in addition, we know of significant capital funds that are needed. And that's the project that we're working on called the Vision Fund. And we have a list of those things. And right now we're working on the priorities of those, and we figure it'll be anywhere between $800,000 and about $1 million in capital funds we need over 5 years. And that information will all be distributed to all the people on our list so they can be informed, and we'll be asking them over a period of 3 years to help us meet some of those needs.
What's the sources of your ongoing funds? I mean,
two sources. The fees you pay and the gifts that people send in.
As I understand the situation today, and I have evaluated this the last few days with Elmer and others, I feel that it's not enough that this village operates just barely in the black. They have to have a reserve, and that's what they're in need of now. It's dangerous to have an operation this large without a reserve. There are things that could happen here like that happens in any industry. For instance, the banks today, many of them are broke because they didn't set up reserves. And we could go broke here on the same basis. So this is something that Elmer will need some help on.
I tell our LWLM, we have $1 million budget this year, and so I'll put Holden Village on next year for some help.
That's the spirit that developed here in the beginning. And it's nice to see that it's still here. We had people come up here and say, you need this, don't you? And you need that. Some of them, one man came and he says, you need a bus, don't you? And I said, yes, we need one. Well, in 2 weeks we had a bus. It didn't cost us anything. Others saw we needed the hydro plant. That didn't cost anything. And others saw other things, and that's the way it goes. And if you challenge people, I think that they'll all have a hand in providing this reserve that is so needed today. Yeah, well, I think it's about time for the service over there. Unless you have something else that's pressing, I want to thank you for coming. It was kind of a rambling thing. I didn't know just what to say tonight because I thought I'd said it all before.